I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are microbiologist Elizabeth Blackburn and health psychologist Alyssa Eppel. They're joined in conversation by the New York Times' Anahad O'Connor. And now, join Warren Browner on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Elizabeth Blackburn, Alyssa Eppel, and Anahad O'Connor.
Like many of you, I made a New Year's resolution to improve my health, and I think the good news is it turns out that tonight you might actually learn a little bit about how to do that, and the secret may be in our DNA. In their new book on the science of aging called The Telomere Effect, A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, and Longer, molecular biologist Elizabeth Blackburn and health psychologist Alyssa Eppel explain that putting research findings into everyday practice can really change how you live and how long you may live, all the way down into the nitty-gritty of ourselves throughout all of our organs. Nobel laureate Eric Kandel called The Telomere Effect, and I quote, one of the most exciting health books to emerge in the last decade. And speaking of Nobel laureates, we have Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who received the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 2009 with two colleagues for their work on telomerase and how telomeres affect cells and aging. And she's currently president of the Salk Institute after spending many years on the faculty at UCSF. Alyssa Eppel, whose PhD, is a leading health psychologist studying stress, aging, and obesity. She's the director of the UCSF Center on Aging, Metabolism, and Emotion, and associate director of the Center for Health and Community. They're appearing in conversation with Anahad O'Connor, a best-selling author and reporter for the New York Times, who covers health, fitness, nutrition, and epidemiology. And now, without further ado, please join me in giving them a warm welcome to our stage here at the JCC.
So I write about health for the New York Times, and I cover everything from, you know, food, nutrition. I write a lot about sugar lately, processed foods, obesity, medicine. You know, one of the things I like to write about are things we can do to actually live healthier, longer lives. That's something that's very important to me, and I'm sure to everyone else in this room. And so I was really excited about this book because over the years I've seen so much research trickling in about telomeres and why they're so important, and you know, all the different things they affect, how they can predict sort of aging and disease. And I think this book really ties all of that research together and really does an amazing job of digging deep into this topic of a really fascinating biomarker and really leaves no stone unturned. And so there's sort of a few broad, I guess, approaches I wanted to take tonight, or a few things I wanted to cover, which, you know, first is, you know, essentially what telomeres are and why they're so important. Number two, why maintaining them can actually help slow the aging process and potentially disease. And then number three, you know, how we can actually change our environments to promote better, healthier telomeres for everyone. Mm. So in this book, you know, there's a really fascinating anecdote where, you know, you talk about the discovery of telomeres and how that began, and surprisingly, with pond scum. So can you tell us about the discovery of telomeres and how you came upon them?
Well, I was fascinated by how things work, how life works, and nobody knew what was at the ends of chromosomes, excepting something or other that under the microscope looked like a little blob, but it was known that if that wasn't there, the chromosomes were not very stable, the genetic material wasn't protected, and so I dived in a molecular way and said, what's the DNA like? And the DNA turned out to be fascinating and to be replenished in a fascinating way. And so leaving the question of then, well, what is a telomere? And so rather than spelling out all the names of the proteins and the DNA and so on, when you said tied together, I thought, well, this is good because this is a very good moment for me to bring an analogy out, which is shoelaces. And so if you think of a shoelace and think about the protective tips at the ends of shoelaces, you know, you really need these to stop the ends from fraying away. And so what telomeres do is act to protect the terminal parts of the DNA, and so all your genes are going to be in chromosomes like this, you know, all the way along the chromosomes. You've got 46 in every cell, you know, 100 million million cells throughout your body. So you've got a lot of little shoelaces here. And the ends are these special DNA sequences. There's a sheath of special proteins, and the ends can be built up by an enzyme that we discovered back in the 1980s. Why did we use pond scum? Really, because they have a lot of these, and they're very short, is the bottom line. And so if you're a good mathematician and you say very short linear things, that means a lot of ends. And so that was as simple as that. And then we figured if there was a lot of DNA that had to be put onto the ends at certain times in the life cycle of this harmless little pond scum organism, maybe we could tease out mythical enzyme that didn't exist in textbooks, but we suspected its existence because something was stopping ends from getting frayed and wearing down, and that something was an enzyme we named telomerase, put a word in the English dictionary, it's in Webster's now, telomerase, and it adds DNA back when the telomeres wear down. So fast forward, they wear down as we get older, and that was the decades of work after the 1980s when we'd been working in pond scum, that more and more in humans showed that that wearing down was something happening during our many, many decades of life as humans. But one had to really study this in humans to find out that it is a factor in our rather long lifespans that really is contributing to some of the aspects of aging.
And now sticking on the cellular level, in the book you talk about, you know, scientists when they were studying longevity decades ago, how they discovered certain things like the Hayflick limit, that there's a certain number of times that our cells reproduce and there seems to be a limit. And can you talk about that and how that ties into telomeres?
Yes. And so again, in the pond scum, we found if you took telomerase away, the telomeres gradually shortened and then the cells stopped dividing. And we said, that's similar to something we've heard of, which is the Hayflick limit, which was Hayflick took normal cells, say from skin, and just let them multiply in the lab. And found that, no, unlike a cancer cell, which does keep replicating over and over, unfortunately, these normal cells actually stop dividing after a while. And so the mystery remained until about the 1990s, and then it became clear that their telomeres were wearing down, and when they got to the point where they're worn down enough, the cells stop multiplying, they send signals out, alarm signals, which, if they're in the body, start having effects that can affect other parts of the body, and they can't replenish tissues throughout life. So if you think of our immune system has to be producing billions of cells every day, and when those stem cells that produce the immune system, the gut lining, our hair, you know, our skin, even our liver, a lot of us is just reproducing cells all the time throughout our lifespans, and that wears down that ability, and it's partly caused by this running down of the telomeres. Other factors play in, but this is one factor that you can quantify how much the running down of the telomeres is going on, and that's what's been the subject of all the studies that inspired us to write the book, because we wanted to put all the studies in together.
Now, I know in research, one way that you can tell the importance of, you know, of a biomarker or something like telomeres is by taking them away and seeing what happens. And in the book you talk about people who actually have a genetic disorder.
So nature sadly has done that, and that proved that telomeres were not a mere biomarker but were actually very important in their maintenance in causing us to be able to keep our health and in fact our lives. And in the book we talk about that, in fact real individuals and it's very clear that if you have a mutation in one of the genes dedicated to maintaining telomeres and nothing else, that is sufficient, even though the gene is coming from only one parent and the other parent gave a good gene, having only one good gene instead of two good genes for that particular protein that maintains telomeres, now you've got half the gene dosage. And very sadly, people become afflicted. These individuals get afflicted with very early onsets of things that are a sort of exaggerated version of what happens in older age, like things like, most prominently, the immune system simply gets exhausted and they can't fight off infections. But they get certain cancers, they get certain other things, cardiovascular, osteoporosis. A lot of signs of aging come very early. Now, these are luckily very rare. It was very critical because it told us that this is important. Half of the amount of that machinery to keep the telomeres going, not good enough for humans. So now the big question was, for all the rest of us, fortunate enough not to have these rare things, those variations in how well our telomeres are maintained, do they matter? And the bottom line is that genetics variation, it plays a bit of a role, but actually there are things that are going on in our lives that play bigger roles and have bigger effects on this ability to maintain telomeres throughout life and keep your health span longer.
So it's this question of nature versus nurture.
Not versus. I think they're all...
Nature and nurture.
They are working together. They're working together. The nature, the genetic effects are not that big, but they're useful because they tell us about causality. But the effect sizes they have are actually not as big. Right, wouldn't you say, as the effect sizes that you see from things that are not our genes. And that's why the book is encouraging, because, you know, we it's too late to choose our parents, but we can choose a lot of things throughout our lives. And that's what was so interesting, that the genes were not your sole destiny. They were useful for understanding underlying mechanisms, but they really are not the big thing in terms of how well your telomeres are maintained. And we care about that because that is quantitatively reflecting our risks for the major diseases that, you know, come upon us in various frequencies and times as the population ages.
Right. And now, Alyssa, maybe you can jump in here because you study environment. And for example, I saw in the book that there was a lot of research on environmental factors. And there's been a lot of research on children and their telomere length and how that can predict disease or predict, you know, certain long-term outcomes. Can you talk about some of that research and
what we've
learned
from it? And I think that was the game changer for us, that when we saw that there were things in our environment, our social and our physical environment, that were actually related to our cell aging, our telomere length inside, that was a compelling reason to get the story out, because it's not just about our own mindset and our own health behaviors, but actually our social environments, our communities, and those are things we can only change and affect together. So that was really the last chapter in the book, where we talk about the, you know, taking a step back and seeing that if all of this is true, what it really means is that social policies and the social fabric that we create together is going to be extremely important for our health span and our longevity. Before we leave the genetics, I don't want to gloss over this small effect that genes have in predicting mortality. If someone saw, if an expert like Warren Browner saw this maybe 2 years ago, he would say, but is it a marker or a mechanism? And so this has been an ongoing question. Do they really matter? Are they causal? Are they just happening as we age? They're shortening and they're just predicting things, but they're not actually causing it. And so now we have this handful of studies showing that your genes in all of us, our genes for long telomeres, are protecting us from developing heart disease and dementia and dying early.
Right, and it's a handful of studies, but done in tens of thousands of people. That's what's so interesting.
Yeah.
It's really very, very robust.
Right.
And so, we thought it was very important to get the best information out to people and make sure it was synthesized in one place in the book, because it says, yes, this really is something that is a part and parcel of what is affecting ultimately even our mortality rates. And most mortality, of course, in adults, as you know, in developed countries, in the general population, a lot of it's attributed to the sort of big three, as they say, you know, cardiovascular cancers, diabetes, and one is now adding, you know, lung and neurodegenerative diseases. All of these, there are small but now clearly discernible effects of genetic variations in specific telomere genes. So we know these genes are not doing anything else. They're dedicated to telomere maintenance. And, you know, that's from a very large amount of molecular studies in many labs around the world.
Right.
So it's part of what's going on. It's in the background, silently going on throughout the decades of our lives. Not the only aging mechanism at all. Of course it's not. Wouldn't it be nice if we were that simple? We're not. There's much more to aging, but it's clearly a contributor. And the beauty is that one can do something about it. That's why we...
And we'll definitely get to what you can do about that.
Yeah.
But I'd love to dig a little deeper down into a couple things since we're, you know, on this topic. So you talk about these different aspects of health and these different diseases where telomere length seems to play a role. What's the sort of underlying or common mechanism here? You
know, okay,
you
yes.
heart
one word.
Disease. Like, what's
one
going
word
on?
It, for the mechanism of the social and the psychological?
Right.
One word that explains most of that is feeling safe, safety. So, would we say our cells are listening? Our telomeres are listening. Of course, we don't mean it literally, with sound and hearing. But we really mean it through chemical messengers. And the way that our environment and our mindset and our stress are sifting down to affecting the rate of our telomere shortening is through biochemical signals, and a large theme of that is safety. Let's just say stress. So the free radicals are affecting telomerase and telomeres. So oxidative stress hormones, insulin resistance, certainly certain chemicals in the environment that we can talk about. But when it comes to why is it that good relationships and neighborhoods where we feel safe and feelings of mastery versus feeling, you know, threatened and on edge, why are these related to telomere shortening? And so just to really boil it down is we are biologically evolved as a social species. We feel safe when we feel supported by people, whether it's a concept of feeling like you have lots of social support, or you know, living in a community where people are actually caring and compassionate, it's this safety that is creating a more restorative cellular environment where telomeres are maintained by telomerase for years and years. So we know now that when you measure neighborhood, and you measure the different parts of it, so being unsafe, violence, trash, aesthetics, and trust. The things that rise to the top, all of those may matter a little bit, but what rises to the top is actually feeling safe in your neighborhood versus wanting to move and feeling threatened.
Mm. And over what sort of period of time does this play out? Because
Years. Yeah, you can see effects over a few months with certain interventions. So that'll tell you things are being pushed in a trending direction.
Yeah.
But we're really talking about things that will play out over years.
Right.
These diseases of aging, you know, that we just thought were so inevitable, you know, cardiovascular, the major causes of death, they really build up over years. And so understanding that these processes of maintaining telomeres throughout your body and preventing cells from getting into states where they can't do their proper functioning and replenishment, understanding that this is playing out over years is good. I mean, it gives you a lot of time, right? Right. So being forewarned and saying, let's preempt things, I think is a big trend in where medicine is going, in addition to, of course, treating, you know, clinically established diseases. And this is a very interesting part of that, because it's playing out over years, and the kinds of things where stress, you know, short-term, intense challenge stress, right? Mm-hmm. That's not so bad. It's when it's prolonged and plays out over years, your telomeres can't bounce back from that. And then you see these longer-term readouts in statistical likelihoods of both telomeres being shortened and then related to that, the increased risks of onsets of some of these conditions of aging.
Yeah. You're listening to microbiologist Elizabeth Blackburn and health psychologist Alyssa Eppel, who are co-authors of the new book, The Telomere Effect, a revolutionary approach to living younger, healthier, longer. They're joined in conversation by Anahad O'Connor on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When I hear you guys talking about these buzzwords that you're throwing out with, you know, stress, you know, you talk about these diseases, it sounds like one of the sort of underlying common themes here may be sort of a chronic inflammatory state. I mean, that seems to be something
that looks
research
like
is showing is really tied to all these, these chronic health problems.
It's very intimately related, because when the telomeres get shortened to the point where they send alarm signals out that I referred to, some of that consists of pro-inflammatory proteins that now become systemic, and that then increases the way the immune system is now producing more inflammatory kinds of signals. It's shifting the balance of your very complex immune system. That pro-inflammatory state looks like it's a vicious cycle that's coming back and actually itself feeding on the shortening of the telomeres, because strangely enough, the telomere DNA is particularly susceptible to the oxidative stress conditions that go along with a pro-inflammatory state. However, we do know from genetics that it's the telomere shortening that can set that up, but then it might be a vicious cycle after that. So the pro-inflammatory state that then plays into risks of things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, it's now thought even some of the neurodegenerative diseases, dementias, that kind of slow-acting process is probably a part and parcel of this thing that we read out as telomere measures in cohorts, but mechanistically I think is really playing a role.
So we know that these factors can, it sounds like, really influence telomere shortening. Mm-hmm. Has there been research showing, ways that you can stop or slow this shortening, or perhaps even reverse it to some extent?
That's why we actually wrote the book, because it said that there actually are some things in people's power that make quantifiable differences.
So there are a handful of experimental studies or interventions where we have measures before people do an activity repeatedly and after. And so those are
randomized controlled studies.
Right, those we can tell you about, and they're what we're most comfortable talking about. But we really are in a position of having hundreds of studies that are correlational. And if we waited till we had experiments on all of these, is living in this unsafe neighborhood for 10 years shorten your telomeres? If we waited for that type of certainty where we were only basing, you know, our conclusions on longitudinal studies and on experiments, we would most certainly be dead and not here to tell you the story. And so we're really, you know, it's uncomfortable as a scientist to say, yes, neighborhoods can shorten telomeres, because of course we haven't done these experiments. It's really just the inference from so many of these correlational studies. And some of these studies are what we call dose response studies, where we know that the amount of exposure to a stressful environment is related to the length of telomeres as adults. So for example, Owen Wolkowitz, our colleague at UCSF, has shown that it's not just whether you have depression or not that determines whether you have short telomeres, although in some studies that pops up, but it's really lifetime days of major depression, and further, it's of untreated major depression when you're not on on a medication or antidepressant. That adds up in a kind of a dose-response way in these nice correlations to correlate with telomere length. And there's all sorts of studies that show these similar things. Years of living with a domestic abusive partner, years of or numbers of traumas as a child.
And on the good side, exposure to violence as children, too, right?
Adding up these traumatic stressors as a child is related to shortening over time, not just shorter telomeres at one time point. And on the good side, being an exerciser, being active for 10 years predicts longer telomeres in adulthood. So it's those types of dose response studies where we see that it's the amount of exposure is really shaping our telomeres later in life. And so what is, you know, revolutionary here, it may not be what we think. It's not that we have an answer for extreme longevity and it's doing something extreme, that, you know, we can do extreme exercise or extreme calorie restriction. or extreme cutting something out of our diet. It's none of that. What we really know is how to have a healthy lifespan, how to have those later, pushing off disease till the end of life, till the later years. And that story is about, comes down to what we do every day, and it's the small things. And so we have, you know, 50 things in this book that we know about our choices every day and our lifestyle that we think matter. And so I think it comes down to, you know, if you were asked me what are some of the most toxic things and what are some of the most protective things, those are easier to talk about. Those kind of rise to the top in most of the studies. But you want to know about the experiments. So what intervention studies have been done to lengthen telomeres? For whatever reason, maybe because of our because of what works or because of our interest, the handful of studies that have been done, the real clinical trials, controlled trials with large samples, have been on mindfulness.
And exercise has been one. Not that we've done, but others mm-hmm. have done exercise, controlled, randomized mm-hmm. Studies as well.
Right? Mm-hmm. In Prestel, the randomized mm-hmm. trial. But yes, mm-hmm. so exercise, and we're pretty confident about that one too, yeah. from so many different studies, looking at twins and, you know, people with the same genetics. The sedentary twin tends to have shorter telomeres. Mm-hmm. But back to the wow. to the intervention studies, so there are some studies on nutrition showing that omega-3 supplementation, the more you absorb it in your blood, the longer your telomeres are months later. In terms of stress reduction, it's not just meditation. There's really a whole range of different mind-body techniques that have been studied. And so the telomere is really not favoring mindfulness, although lots of reasons why that's a really great strategy for stress resilience. But Qigong, so a simple movement that's focusing attention and reducing stress arousal in the body, that's been shown in a couple studies to boost up telomerase, the enzyme that protects telomeres. The Dean Ornish program, so that's right, on right. a little bit more on the extreme side, but that has also been looked very promising.
Yeah. Okay, it's very heartening to hear that, because I wake up every morning and say, okay, this morning I'm going to actually start my mindfulness program, and I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes, and maybe tomorrow morning would be that morning.
It's a little
so
bit like,
I'm actually surprised
yes.
to hear you say that meditation is not.
Well, yeah. rather short duration meditations in a 3-month study were quite influential in, you could see a difference between the people who did just simple relaxation for 10-12 minutes a day versus a rather more focused mindfulness mm-hmm. study. Okay. So you know, these are very interesting studies because they're very consistent with the many observational
yeah.
studies.
And so both of these interventions that Liz is mentioning are on our book website on the Mind Body page. If you want to try them, one is called Curtain Kriya, and it's, you'll want to do it alone because you might feel silly chanting and moving your fingers, but my research colleagues at UCLA do it every day for 10 or 12 minutes, and it is most definitely training their attention, their probably executive function, and giving their body a restorative break. So the Kirtan Kriya is becoming popular, especially in the Alzheimer's prevention area. Hmm. And the other one at the top of that page is Qigong. And I think it's gorgeous. If you look at these videos, I think you might feel relaxed just watching it. And anyone can do it, any age. And the studies are pretty compelling.
Wow, okay. So the first one was?
It's called yogic meditation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Kirtan Kriya is another name for it. There's a handful in terms of stress resilience. What was partly fun about this book was looking at all of the, what we study is meditation, but there are all sorts of cognitive and, let's just say, tricks or things you can do to reappraise or re-experience the really hardest things in life that cause suffering or cause big stress responses. And so a lot of our colleagues have done lab studies with different reframing techniques, reappraisal, distancing, these powerful manipulations that work in the lab that haven't been turned into classes at Kaiser yet, but try them because they're pretty impressive. And if you are looking for research-based ways to build up stress resilience, I think they're worth trying on. You know, there's a menu to that people need to try out, because I think it's not one, you know, shoe fits all, like you said. I think mindfulness is certainly very popular, but it's not for everyone.
Okay. Yeah. One thing that I found really fascinating in the book, and this is something that I've noticed over the years as a health reporter, you know, writing about different things you can do for your health, is that there's this sort of phenomenon of too much of a good thing, or a U-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. So we know that, you know, people who drink a little bit of alcohol, a little bit of red wine on a daily basis, they have longer lifespans than people who are abstainers. But then if you have too much, then your lifespan, life expectancy goes down again, and you see these sorts of things where there's a U-shaped curve. And we're talking about, you know, telomere shortening, but in the book you also talk about what can go wrong when your telomeres are too long. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the other side?
Yes. So this is where genetics really showed something very interesting, because everything was looking as though having more genetic capacity to maintain your telomeres, this was looking good. But, you know, we live many, many decades, and there are various things that can go wrong, and there are many different kinds of cancers. And what emerged a few years ago was, for a few different kinds of cancers, if you had natural variations of telomere-specific genes that just nudge the telomeres a bit longer, risks for brain cancers, melanoma, and non-smoker lung cancers all were related to the gene variants that nudge your telomeres up. And this was very interesting. It was a study out of UCSF initially, where they simply said, what are the risk factors for adult glioma in the whole genome? They just said, let the genome speak to us. We're not going to come in with any, you know, hypothesis and force it into some reality. Mm-hmm. Up popped the telomere genes. Whoa. And they were the ones that said, if you urge too much telomerase, you're pushing yourself into a risk for those cancers. Now, overall, if you look 40,000 feet up and look at populations, hundreds of, you know, now literally tens of thousands of people, overall, having longer telomeres is better for overall cancer risks. But for those cancers, it nudges the risks up. So what it's saying is, okay, we've got to really think. We're walking a tightrope here, so we need to be thinking about telomere maintenance as something where we don't know how to stray off, you know, some kind of optimal median. Mm. So what was very interesting was that cancers, if a cell is fully cancerous, if it's a human cancerous cell, there's a 90% chance it's got really revved up telomerase. So telomerase is like Mr. Hyde in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Normally throughout our bodies it's Dr. Jekyll, but in the setting of a cancer cell or cells that are prone to become cancerous, it turns into that dark side. So what it said was, okay, we take home from that, use physiological ways to maintain your telomeres, which is not just telomerase being nudged up, but a lot of things in cells nudge telomeres up or down. But let that happen in a physiological way, because nobody got cancer from exercise, I can assure you, and from eating, you know, healthy diets and so on. You know, there's nothing that suggests that happens. Mm-hmm. So that's what we've learned, you know, not to monkey with things we don't know about by everyone would love a pill. Make your telomerase active. And it just emerged in the last few years. Oops, that may not be a good idea. Cancers take, you know, many years to develop. You could take something and think, oh, fine, you know, 2 years gone by, 3 years gone by. Cancers take a long time to develop. So that's what's been learned by genetic studies, which give you causality. But then knowing that, we said, okay, now we know a little bit more. We've got to realize that we're on a delicately balanced path here. Mm. You know, we live so many decades that very small effects can accumulate. You know, something that's having a tiny effect 1 year, it'll add up year after year, and, you know, it'll tip things over into a risk that, you know, wouldn't show up after a small number of years, wouldn't show up in a short-lived mouse or something like right. that, where a lot of things are studied.
Right.
So it's fascinating in humans. You know, we're the most interesting species, I think, in lots of ways. And we also probably know the most about us compared with every other species on the planet. But we live a very long time, so there's a lot of time for things to go right or go wrong.
Right, absolutely. And Alyssa, I know in the book you talk about some of the research that you guys have done with children. There's ongoing research at UCSF. Can you tell us sort of what your ongoing research is looking at, and also if there, I mean, this book is loaded with lots of good studies and science, but are there still some remaining questions about telomeres that the experts like yourself would still like to
uncover
and answer?
Yes, and that's looking at telomeres younger and younger in life has been really one of the most interesting areas and the areas that we're pursuing now. So we talked about how inflammation, how it rises up slowly over time as we age, and that creates this fertile ground for diseases of aging and cancer. And that is something that does happen later in life with age in humans, unless there's a lot of obesity and metabolic disease. Most of the biomarkers go awry kind of after 50 and they're correlated to disease. Telomeres are really different because, you know, we have a given telomere length on average from day one of birth. And that's what we start off with. It's very important, what we call kind of initial set point. And it turns out that we know the things that are shaping that in the womb besides genetics. And we know the things that shape it in childhood. And these are really big changes that determine where we end up later in life. So we do have small changes in adulthood, but the changes in childhood are huge relative to how much we slow down in adulthood. So here are some of the things we found. And Janet Wojcicki at UCSF has been pioneering looking at mom factors, maternal health factors, and how that predicts telomere length on day one. So we measure telomere length in cord blood. So here's some of the factors that we have learned so far, and also our colleagues at Irvine, Patik Wadhwa. We've all been collaborating on this work together and finding that both mental health, having a lot of stressful events during pregnancy, having low folate, low estradiol, and low education, these are predictors of short telomeres in the cord blood on day one of life. So some of this is kind of a shock to us, because if a mother's level of education, if completing high school is related to a longer telomere length in her baby.
If
it's protective.
Yes. Sorry, yeah.
And so conversely, if not finishing high school is leading to a baby starting off life with short telomeres for the rest of their life, we're not starting with a level playing field.
This is why we're saying that social kinds of conditions are really something to think about with this very different kind of a lens, which is, you know, a lens that's very objective, measuring in cohorts of people in studies, something that has a quantifiable relationship with risks of later diseases. One study even showed that a very stressful situation for moms, actually you could trace back for even 20-year-old young women, telomere effects to what had happened to the mother. It had to be a very severe, stressful event, but during the pregnancy. So these things really start to reverberate out in ways which is not just, you know, me and my health. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, these are very interesting implications.
Right.
And that's what, in answer to your question, that's what would be so important to start really studying this much more.
And so,
nobody thought to study it before, but the effect started showing up. And
and the environment that we're giving our kids from early on are also showing up in their telomeres. So you wouldn't think that many three-year-olds have soda, but in one of Janet's studies, there were a significant number of toddlers having soda, and those who had it four times a week had greater rate of telomere shortening in their toddlerhood. And we think this is bad also from our cross-sectional studies, and Cindy Leung has found this in women. If they're having less soda during pregnancy, their telomeres are actually lengthening. So we do think soda is one of those particularly toxic factors, because it's liquid sugar and it's going to cause a huge biochemical stress response if you're having it particularly every day. So we know that childhood, the telomeres are being shaped, and does it matter? And does this track through the lifespan, and does it predict disease if you're born with short telomeres? We don't have that type of longitudinal studies yet. We certainly want to know. We're starting this to do these studies. And one of our questions is, besides the genetics, we can rule out genetics, we can measure what we know determines longer telomeres from GWAS studies. Are the environmental contributions toward telomere length, so mom's and dad's telomere length, controlling for genetics, shaping the baby's telomere length? So if, for example, a mother has had a lot of stress and has short telomeres from that, does that being epigenetically transmitted to the baby? And so far, We're just starting those studies, but what we do know is when we look at parents with short telomeres because of a genetic cause, they may give their short telomeres to their all of their offspring. Some get the bad gene and some don't. And the ones who did not inherit the bad genes for telomeres still have short telomeres. So that is called epigenetic transmission. That is non-genetic, environmentally determined transmission from parents to offspring. That's what we're dealing with here. That's why telomere is so interesting, because it's actually shaping the next generation's, you know, aging process, or where, at least for this particular aging mechanism, where they're starting from. How much does that matter? That, you know, it's looking like it does. So, for example, in little toddlers who have short telomeres, if you look at them at 8 years old, 4 years later, they have greater buildup of their carotid artery wall. So those very earliest signs of heart disease are already starting in little kids with short telomeres.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features microbiologist Elizabeth Blackburn and health psychologist Alyssa Eppel, who are co-authors of the new book, The Telomere Effect, A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, Longer. They're joined in conversation by Anahad O'Connor. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Yeah, I think that was the big surprise, that we thought this was something to do with aging, and what it really is more and more pointing to is these are things that are happening throughout the life course. And there were medical studies that said conditions, pregnancy did predict hypertension, diabetes, you know, and the situations of severe deprivation and so forth in pregnancy. The children, when they grew up, had more hypertension, more diabetes. But to see that this kind of thing happening throughout life in ways that you can quantify with the telomeres, you know, this was really quite unexpected and makes you realize that, you know, how you're going to age has got a certain amount of it predictable by what's happening through your life course and even in utero. So it's just become more and more fascinating, you know, the more you look. And as you said, the more things, you know, one wants to ask and really understand, you know, how reversible are these effects in children? In fact, in adults with post-traumatic stress disorder, who are particularly susceptible to that because they've had adverse childhood events, their telomere shortness as adults was proportional to the number of categories of childhood adversity they had experienced. And here it was in these adults. Mm-hmm. And it was things that had happened back there. So that was probably a more sensitized situation because of really severe things that had happened, but you could discern these effects. So it's not just about aging. And so, you know, when we're now thinking of, well, you know, not of ourselves, but, you know, younger people in our lives, we've got to be thinking about these things. So measuring them and really understanding where are the big effects.
So looking at the bigger picture, you know, are there certain, I know the research is still ongoing, but are there certain policy implications we can draw from this, things on the sort of bigger picture level that you think could... help to improve?
Well, I'll take one.
Okay.
I was just going to take the simplest possible, which was the study Alyssa alluded to, which was that folate levels, when they were low in a pregnant mom, were reflected in shorter telomeres in her newborn. And so what does that talk about? It's talking about something very simple: good prenatal care, good prenatal nutrition, you know, making sure that is really widely available. You know, that's a very simple example, and it doesn't tell us something that we didn't know. It just tells us something in a very different kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you have ones that you...
So we already know we need to put more into education and the, you know, invest in children, and that's what's going to make us a happier, more healthy, educated, progressive society. But it turns out that really it's about women of childbearing age, and that their health has, their obesity, depression, these things have huge effects on their offspring. And when we start to try to help women in pregnancy with weight or depression, we need to do that, but it's actually too late. We need to start before they get pregnant. And so that means really our population that we need to target is actually a huge segment of the society. Young girls are the ones who are gaining weight too early and then ending up with obesity at childbearing age. So we need to start even earlier. So it's, you know, it is a intergenerational transmission, a cycle where we need to think about how do we protect life from its earliest days. And so at the very basic level, we need to think about the big toxic stressors, poverty and violence, and making sure basic needs are met. And that's not a very exciting idea, but it is critical if we have a chance at, you know, a healthy, productive life with a health span that's reasonable. We need to eliminate those toxic stressors. So those are the social policies, the social nets, the WIC, the aid to what we used to call food stamps, the nutrition aid to these low-income families. That is absolutely critical. These families are working so hard and benefit so much from that level of help. So those are the types of social policies that get rid of the really big toxic stressors and let people have a chance at getting an education, getting a better job, moving up. But there's another type of change that can't be through policy, and it has to be through our own changes at the most local level within ourselves, within those that we're in touch with in our family, our communities, our neighborhoods, our schools, our workplaces. What we know from telomere research is what really is toxic to telomeres: discrimination, violence, chronic stress, extreme poverty.
Exposure to certain classes of quite common things like agricultural workers, pesticides. There was clear relationships mm-hmm. to telomere mm-hmm. shortness and occupational right. lead exposures. You know, things mm-hmm. that we knew were bad,
right.
but it's another way that message gets hammered
right.
home in quantifiable ways.
Right. So Meryl Streep yeah. said it really well yesterday, yes. that yeah. hate breeds hate, mm-hmm. and modeling violence, it makes it acceptable and makes it the norm. So my point is, we already know what's here on the toxic side, and we also know what's protective is social relationships. And it's the opportunity is the cultural change for us to how we're going to act from the moment we wake up to the people around us. And that is not a policy that has got to come from us. So I think we're in mm-hmm. crisis as a society, and we are seeing bad players, and we're seeing haters, and that is making, you know, certain people, particularly vulnerable people, people of color, people who are immigrants, etc., be very threatened. And the backlash to that is up to us. Are we going to take charge of our emotional and social cultural? Are we going to transform it? The opportunity is now, and that is what is going to transform our own physiology. And our physiology is correlated. I mean, one of the most exciting things to me is like the research of my colleagues Wendy Mendez, that our nervous systems, our synchrony is actually correlated with those who are around you and who are close to you. So if you think that your own health is just stops right here, you're wrong, because your partner's health and the people you interact with every day are actually affecting you. I know that sounds a little bit woo-woo. The data is going to be coming in soon. So we really just need to think about what kind of community are we creating in our neighborhoods? Are we feeling trust and building trust? Are we doing anything proactive to create this kind of caring and compassionate culture that we all benefit from, we all want? Doesn't matter what political party you're from. No one really supports these haters except for the haters.
Right. And I don't think that research is woo-woo at all. I mean, I've seen studies, for example, looking at the contagiousness of chronic disease mm-hmm. and who you surround yourself with
yes.
can determine mm-hmm. Can influence
yes.
everything from your emotional state to even obesity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and so these...
Good point.
And it can happen across
yeah.
social media
yeah.
as well. People separated by
right.
thousands of miles
yeah.
on Facebook.
Yes, good point. And the tie-in is that, you know, the thoughts, your state of mind, your, you know, habits of thinking, that they do have these very, very real physiological effects. And so it's not crazy that, you know, contagiousness of these so-called non-contagious diseases is observed, because you can see that there's a real physiological route through mm-hmm. which this would happen. And part of that would be this telomere maintenance aspect. Not everything, but it's certainly something that, you know, we say this is part of the picture. And, you know, the messages keep being very, very consistent.
Yeah. I want to make sure to mention my lab was very busy today putting some questionnaires on the web for you guys. So I want to make sure I mention them. When we talk about change needs to start from within us, that is noticing our own habits of mind and how we're responding to people around us, events around us, what our different kind of personalities are that make us more maybe stress reactive or less stress reactive. So, you know, research-based measures and say, is this helpful to people? We already know that pessimism and hostility are related to shorter telomeres. Conscientiousness is related to longer telomeres. Does it help you if you know what your style is? Where do you fall on these scales? And then can you be more aware of those tendencies? And can that help diffuse them? So we're not trying to change people's personality. That doesn't happen anyway very easily. But it's actually the awareness of our own responses that can be transformative. And mindfulness practice particularly promotes that awareness of the thoughts and the feelings so that the first step to changing from within is the awareness. And then that is allows us to have a different relationship with, to have equanimity when the world is crazy around us, and we can share that with others. So please log on to our website. If you just type in AME and UCSF, AME is aging, metabolism, and emotions. And we have a site where you can assess different aspects of your habits of thinking. And let me know if it's helpful. And I'm going to change the website tomorrow if I get a lot of emails that says, this was upsetting.
Or, this is your chance to make a difference here.
Well, very, very powerful words. And, you know, the book is fantastic. It's covers a lot of ground. You know, what you wrapped up with, Alyssa, could not have come at a more appropriate time than when the country is in tumult and transition. And but I'm sure the audience has a lot of questions for you, so hopefully we can get to some of those. So why don't we turn it over to you guys?
Thank you. Let's go ahead.
The first question is on your right.
Thank you. Carrie Heater from Michigan State University. I design and study meditation interventions. And I was wondering how quickly telomere length change is observable.
So Cliff Sarin and Quinn Conklin from UC Davis have a paper hopefully you'll all see in the next year. So it's not quite in press yet, but the abstract's online. And they've looked at a one-month meditation study at Spirit Rock. And so they enrolled experienced meditators, and they also enrolled a control group of experienced meditators because, of course, we all know the problem. Biggest problem with our research is our control groups are different. Meditators like kale chips and normal people like potato chips. So in this study, we measured telomeres before they went into the retreat and 3 weeks later. And we tried to get rid of the transitions because, believe me, we mess up a lot of our studies by bringing people into a new place and taking their blood and you get an acute stress response. It ruins everything. So we try to, we bring people in, they rest, they've already been to the clinic, we take their blood, we get a kind of a baseline telomere length, then we compared that to what they had 3 weeks later. And that was our, that's probably the most dramatic study, and it's a small sample, but what it showed was that 3 weeks after the onset of the meditation retreat, there was apparent telomere lengthening in the meditators. A significant proportion of them lengthened, and the control group who stayed at home had both lengthening and shortening, and on average, no lengthening. Mm-hmm. So that's a hint that we can have short-term change. I think that what really matters is habits over years.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yes.
Yeah, so it's a hopeful proof of concept study. Did that change? Did that boost last? We don't know. Was it per cell change or fresh naive cells coming out from the stores? We don't know. So there's just a lot we don't know. We have a crude little, you know, dark window to look in, but it looks very, very hopeful and promising with short-term changes.
Mostly they are on the order of months. that you can see things, but they tend to drift up and down. I mean, there are five-year changes in elderly, not very healthy people where you can see the mm-hmm. telomere population going actually longer in some people and yeah. and staying the same or shortening in others over a five-year period. So you can see lengthening in people. And interestingly, those people in whom lengthening happened, with several hundred people this was done, their mortality in the next 4 years was about half that of those who had maintained their telomeres or even shortened them. And so it goes up and down, but definitely doing something with an intervention study, very well controlled, looking in the mm-hmm. short term, at least tells you, you know, it's going in the right direction. But we don't know if it persists for months or years. But as Alyssa mm-hmm. is saying, we're really emphasizing in the book, it's changing habits over years and, you know, not just doing a once-off New Year's resolution. You know, I'm going to go to the gym for 3 mm-hmm. hours every day and buy myself all these new Lycra mm-hmm. clothing and, you know, you don't use it, right? Right. It's, we're saying, you know, try and find the yeah. things that you can change because of all the behavioral science that tells you how you can change things in realistic ways over longer periods of time. But for study purposes, it seems like one can, you know, at least look over months, occasionally in this one case, weeks, but probably months to a year is more going to give you a better trend.
Hi, I was wondering how we can get our telomere length measured.
Yes, there. Well, you can be in a study. There's certainly research studies that you know, we've done a lot of studies, and some of which has involved telling people their lengths. But there are commercial companies that do it. We don't have any financial interest in them, so we don't, you know, have any knowledge about what they're doing in terms of, you know, you know, how good they are and so forth, because this is not FDA regulated or anything like that.
Right. Health. So every time I boot up my computer, I see an ad to get my telomeres measured that knows what I, you know, what I'm interested in.
Yes, that's right.
So we are definitely in an era where more of these, you know, companies are it's easy to do and it's available now commercially. It's not regulated. It's really a new science. So if you are one of those people who want to know, my only advice would be to not take it too seriously, because as Liz mentioned in our studies, when we look at it over the short run, it does go up and down.
5 years, it can go up, it can go down. You know, so things really can change.
Right, or even in months, it can go up and down. Yeah. So you might lose weight and want to know if your telomeres improved, and you might find that they shortened. That's a hint. We're seeing Patty Moran's here. We just finished a mindful weight loss study, and we haven't fully understood it yet or published it yet, but clearly the acute weight loss is shortening telomeres. Is that bad for our health? Are they going to be longer mm-hmm. in the long run? There's all sorts of unanswered questions. So I would just say, you view it as an experiment.
Yes, right. I mean, it's really what's happening over years that's counting here.
Well, this has been a fascinating talk. Thank you, everyone. And just so as a reminder, you talked about the website that people can go to. If you can remind people one more time.
Yeah.
You have the book here. You can go... Yes. Pick it up.
Right. So the book website is just www.telomereeffect.com. And then our lab research website at UCSF, where we have some questionnaires, is if you just type in AME UCSF, you'll find it, AME. And actually, our book website links to our lab website. So either way, you'll get to the questionnaires if you want to know. Yeah.
Well, thank you, everyone, and get home safely.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were microbiologist Elizabeth Blackburn and health psychologist Alyssa Eppel, who are co-authors of the new book, The Telomere Effect: A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, Longer. They were joined in conversation by the New York Times' Anahad O'Connor. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, Maya Finley, and Jake Kukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.